Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. This one comes from the Bayfield Pavilion. Hey, in Bayfield, Wisconsin, we have a full house of wonderful Wisconsin Public Radio listeners to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. It's something we've done this 11th year in a row that we've done this, and it's always been a lot of fun. I wish you could all be here. It's a great pavilion. It's a great building. It's lined with exhibitors, some just educating, others selling. You know, you can even buy a goat in this building today, as a matter of fact. And we're having a lot of fun, and I know you're going to have a lot of fun listening to what we talk about today, because we have three guests who can cover pretty much whatever it is you want to cover in the gardening area. First, Jason Fishbach, University of Wisconsin Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. Jason, great to see you. As Don Kissinger, right next to him, Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Don, welcome back.
Hello, Larry. Thank you.
And last but not least, Art Odie, horticulture consultant and semi-retired now from a botanical garden and arboretum management. And Art?
Good morning, Larry. Hope your crew appreciates the fact that we got the snow shoveled away from the door so you guys could get in here.
Hey, it is beautiful. Now, you know, last year there weren't many flowers around town. They had actually already bloomed. This year, things are just about perfect.
Well, they're perfect, except that the daffodils really suffered from being under the snow as long as
yeah.
they were. And I'd say probably 50% of them came up blind without blossoms. So it's pretty out there, but it could be a lot better. We were under a lot of snow here late.
Yeah, and I know there's still a little snow up in the woods, probably, on at least one side of the hill, the shady side of the hill.
Probably on the roof of your car tomorrow morning, too.
Well, I tell you what, it's always a real treat for me to be here, and Judith Sears-Poisson as well, and just a chance to see so many great listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio. The whole gang here is wonderful. I got to be good friends with many of them because of being here for 11 straight years. So it's wonderful. They'll have some questions. I know they do every year. They'll raise their hands, and Judith will have the microphone there. But as you listen in, if you're not lucky enough to be here, but you're listening on the radio, you can call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Well, email us at talk@wpr.org as well, or you can even post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. So give us a call, or if you're in the audience, raise your hand, and we'll see if we can get you on here. I think all of us have been tempted by looking at plants at the nursery and buying them and taking them home and wondering where we're going to put them. Art, what kind of garden planning and design does it really make sense to try and do and stick to?
Well, you mean from a sort of philosophical sense?
Well, yeah.
Well, I've always been attracted, as most of us up here have, to landscaping with native plants. But that's not the be-all, end-all of garden design either. I think that, you know, not from a vegetable gardening standpoint, but from a horticultural woody plant standpoint, there are a lot of different ways to design and a lot of different reasons to design things. There's a lot of tradition in gardening. There's a lot of cultural background that people bring to gardening, and it all has to be respected. And in the final analysis, you have to do what pleases you.
And I think for Bayfield and Bloom there, people are going to have a chance who come to visit are going to have a chance to see some pretty fine gardens as they visit here.
We have great gardens in Bayfield, and they will be absolutely beautiful within the next month or so as time goes on and things warm up. Please come and visit. We have a very gardening-oriented community here.
And if you go to the chambers, bayfield.org, you're going to get the information you need about what's going on, and I hope you will go to bayfield.org. And, of course, one of the guys who's planted quite a few trees up here the last few years, I think, Don Kissinger with the Department of Natural Resources. Don, what are the you got a chance to instill some good tree planting techniques and some good trees to plant.
Well, you know, you had mentioned this is the 11th year that you've been up here, and actually one thing that you didn't mention about Art is among one of the many things he does here is he's the volunteer village forester for the city of Bayfield, and this is their 13th year being a Tree City USA community. So I am and I'm fortunate that I get to come up here. I work with the fourth grade students. We plant a tree or two, teach them how to plant trees properly. And one thing I want to give a shout out to the whole state is that this year we reached 190 Tree City USA communities, which now put us second in the nation for tree cities behind Ohio. But we moved ahead of Illinois, so that's one thing that we should be happy about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, give a hand. I'll clap a little for that, too. What's and to be a Tree City USA, what does it really mean? It means that you've really done your due diligence and worked with trees in your community.
Right. I mean, there's four standards you must meet. Spending $2 per capita on a forestry budget, and that means, you know, the staff or volunteers purchasing trees, planting trees, pruning trees, having an ordinance, having an Arbor Day proclamation. So the mayor, Larry McDonald, read a proclamation. But really, being a tree city has lots of benefits. They found that that businesses, that if they see that a community cares about their trees, that's just as much a part of their infrastructure as other items too, and they're more likely to come to that community to bring their business. So being a tree city is important, and especially I was telling the kids this morning, trees are really important, especially here in the Bayfield area, stormwater retention, you know, mitigating pollution, keeping, you know, heating and cooling in check. So trees and the proper planting as part of the infrastructure is vitally important.
Absolutely. Well, Jason Fishbach, it's great to see you again. We haven't talked. It's been a while since you and I have talked. What's going on up here in this neck of the Wisconsin?
Like usual, it's the weather.
I don't know if we got you on. Are we hearing you okay there? We're having a little trouble with the microphone. There we go.
I'll lean over and steal Don's microphone.
All right. Don't knock him over, though.
Yep. Okay. So, like usual, it's the weather. And I was just down in Madison on Tuesday, and the flowers are out. They're mowing the lawn. Birds are singing. Up here, we've had, I think, 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday, where we can be outside working in the garden the whole spring. So we're way behind, and, you know, one of the things, particularly tree planting, and I'm guilty of it just this morning, is all the plants are starting to arrive from the nurseries that you order, and the soils are still too wet. And we're, especially on our heavy clays up here, you can do a whole lot of damage by planting when it's too early. The trees don't get a good start, and you're behind the eight ball right from the beginning. So we're still waiting, and we're supposed to get 14 inches of rain or whatever it is this weekend. So we'll be... Maybe June we can get out in the gardens.
Well, there's some rain coming on, going on in the southern part of the state, I know as well, after talking to my wife and daughter this morning. One of the beauties of the southern Wisconsin right now are the lilacs. The lilacs are in full bloom in the Madison area. And if you're in the Madison area, I highly recommend the Arboretum, with its acres and acres of lilacs of all types. It's really a heady experience to walk in and smell. It's just wonderful. Well, great to have you guys all here, and I'm sure that you're ready to answer some questions. And if you have a question, join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or comment there. We have callers online. Let's take a call first, and then we'll take a question from the audience. Elise in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
Well, and what's on your mind?
I'm trying to get rid of a grove of sumac. And I don't know how to do it.
Okay. Where are they? Are they, you know, right next to your house, or are they...
They're a little bit off off of the house. When the house was built, they cleared out, you know, an area for the house, but then basically along one side of the property, probably about 40 feet, and then probably 20 to 30 feet over, and then comes to like a triangle type thing on the side of the, in the side of the property.
So you'd like to get rid of all of them or just a few?
Most of it, because my husband is allergic to them, so if he tries to deal with them or walk it through them, his face blows up.
Oh, I am sorry for that. Well, I'm sure he's very sorry about it, too. Dot or Jason, let's see what we can get about. How do we get rid of these? Jason?
Sure. So with most of these creeping rhizomatous perennials, it's sort of a three-part strategy. In the spring, you want to just keep cutting it back to try to starve them, because it's going to force them to use their root reserves to push up new shoots. Then keep at it during the summer. And then in the fall, when you've got that last flush of growth coming up from the rhizomes, then that would be the time to treat it with something like Roundup, a systemic herbicide that's going to move down into that root system and kill it. If you aren't willing to use the herbicides, then it's good old-fashioned persistence and just having to dig them out, keep mowing them back, and eventually you'll starve that out. But it's certainly not a simple process for any of these rhizomatous species.
And Elise, since your husband can't do it, I don't know, it's you or the neighbor boys. I'm thinking neighbor kids. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate
Larry, may I?
Yeah, go ahead, Art.
Ask the caller a question. Are you sure that it's the sumac? I personally have never encountered a real allergic reaction to staghorn sumac. Now there's reactions to the poison sumac, but that grows in swamps. I'm wondering if you haven't got an invasion of poison ivy there amongst the sumacs. And I would look carefully. Jason, have you heard of anybody being really allergic to?
Not to the staghorn.
So look around for poison ivy. Maybe it isn't a sumac.
And don't do like my good friend did, who saw the poison ivy and thought, "Oh, these are interesting plants, but I want to get rid of them all." So she pulled them out by hand with no gloves, and in shorts. And you probably can figure the result of that. Thanks, Elise, for calling. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. And we have a question from the audience. And what's your name?
Josh. I live in Racine. This question is actually from my mom, Diane, down in Elkhorn. And she has an astilbe that never blooms, and it dies back every year. And it's planted in a very sandy soil, and it's in the proper shady spot. And so she's just hoping for your best information.
Astilbe. So it's in a shady spot.
So much for the experts.
The guys that will never be stumped. Yeah. And does she fertilize it a lot?
No, I don't think so, not at all.
Well, that's good. What do you think, Jason?
So I'll make something up. How's that? Well, if it's suffering from, you know, if it's not persistent or if it's not surviving the winter, then it's likely it's stressed going into the winter on the heavy sand or the light sands. Underwatering is potentially a problem, particularly if it's not blooming. The other one would be lack of nitrogen fertilization to keep it nice and healthy. So I think just babying that plant, try it this year. If it dies back, it might be time to take a hint and try a new plant or a new species for that spot. But
all right, well, that's a pretty good guess, Jason. Thanks a lot for that, and thank you for listening in today. We're broadcasting today from Bayfield and Bloom. We're kicking it off at the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, with my guest Jason Fischbach, Don Kissinger, and Art Odie. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller with a great audience at the Bayfield Pavilion, Bayfield, Wisconsin. And you know what? Ah, great to hear that. Great to see everybody here. And we've got three experts, Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield County, Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forest Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, and Art Odie, Horticulture Consultant and Botanist, semi-retired from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. And they've been, I'm trying to remember how many years you guys have been guests on the show. It's been quite a few.
I think it's 10 years.
I think it's the whole time.
Yeah.
Probably not Jason.
Yeah, I think about 6 years.
Six for Jason. And for Don, though, and Art, it's been the whole time. So it's great to have them here. Great to have you listening in. Questions, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Nancy from Salem emailed and said she planted ivy to cover the foundation of her house, but now it's doing what ivy does. It's climbing under the siding and everywhere else. Is there an effective way to control ivy?
Just keep pulling it and cutting it.
Yeah. It does. I don't know what else you can do.
No, unless there's a trellis put on for it between the house and the ivy. Perhaps that'll keep it on the trellis instead of on the siding. But even then, it's going to climb through it.
And ivy does a lot, can do a lot of damage to like brick homes and so forth. I know the University of Wisconsin in Madison spent a fair amount of money getting the ivy off of many of those old brick buildings that are on Bascom Hill. So it's a chore, and you have to keep at it. Rita in Glenwood City, we'll go to you next, and then we'll take a question from the audience. Hi, Rita. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I bought a home,
sure.
And ever since I've been there, they've been, I think it's crocuses. They got little, you know, quite thin leaves with a white strip in the middle, but they never, ever flower. Am I supposed to be doing something to them or for them?
I don't know. Art, what do you think?
Well, I'd look at whether they're properly fertilized, either not enough or too much, because crocus should bloom. There's hardly anything that will keep them from blooming right after the snow melts. So I'd look to soil or fertilizer condition. I don't know. What do you think, Jason?
Art, you're the flower guy.
No. I'm the woody plant guy.
Well, I think you're right.
I think that's it.
I think you're right. So there you go. So you might want to do a little soil test. You know, why not a soil test?
Sure.
And say when you send in the soil sample, you can send it to UW Extension or your county office, and the Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory will take care of that. And if you say, I have crocuses in this area and they don't flower, what's the deal? The nice thing about those soil and plant analysis is you get a little paragraph back saying, well, there's too much fertilizer, or there's too much of this, or not enough of that, and it tells you pretty much exactly what you need to do to get things to work, which is one of the beauties of soil testing. So there we go. Thanks, Rita, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, Larry. My name is LaVita, and I'm a gardener here in Bayfield. You mentioned the beautiful blooming lilacs that are down in Madison, and my husband and I have an alley that's lined with old lilacs that never seem to bloom, or we get one or two, you know, bunches of blossoms, and that's it. And recently, a huge big limb fell down from a white pine and has kind of knocked down some of the older, bigger growth. What would you suggest I do to encourage blooming back there?
Believe it or not, that was probably a good thing to have happen, isn't it, Art?
Rita, I would cut them all down to the ground, and you'll miss a year's bloom or light bloom for a year or two, but they'll rejuvenate, and you'll have what you want.
Yeah, if you want to be conservative about it, what do they say? Cut about a third down every year for 3 years, but they always take the biggest ones if you want to leave something up. But otherwise, I think Art's right. You can whack them down and they'll come back.
Yeah, lilacs are tough because if you do that one-third rule but you start 10 years into it, then it always looks so lopsided when you take out those first couple. So if you put new lilacs in, definitely start. And the mistake, I think, is you take out the younger stuff because you feel like it should clean it up because it's always sending up new shoots every year. But try to take out the older wood so it's replaced with the younger, more vigorous wood.
And you'll get some nice flowering. You should get some nice flowering. Let's go to the phones again. Judy in Wausau. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I have a problem. I have black specks on my siding, and someone told us that it was mold spores coming from I don't know what. And it's only in a certain area on my house. It's not like the whole house isn't full or whatever. But you actually have to scrape them and then scrub them really hard with a real strong degreaser to get rid of it. So is there something like that? Is it a mold spore? I don't know.
Let's turn to Art Odie for that.
Yeah, it's probably mold spores. I'd bet on that. And have you recently put wood mulch down near your house along foundation plantings?
Well, we did, but that was on there before that. Before we
put
that on.
Oftentimes wood mulch will bring in mold, and the mold spores will get on the house siding. But other than that, I suppose if you just want to get rid of the mold spores, I'd try bleach.
So one thing it could be, and you could do a little research, I think it's called shotgun fungus, and it will actually live on the wood chips, and it'll eject the spores, kind of like a shotgun, and it sticks to the side of the house. We actually had an outbreak here in Bayfield about 4 or 5 years ago, and beautiful white siding was covered in these little black dots, and it turned out to be the shotgun fungus. Kind of a fascinating fungus, and it'll live in wood chips for a long time, so even if they're put down a while ago. So that might be something you can do. You can try to scrape off a sample or take some good photos and send them down to Brian Huddleston, and we can get it confirmed, but that'd be my guess.
We had the house before the house that we now own was bright yellow, and we had the same issue on our house. And if you can imagine those black spots on a bright yellow house, it was something to behold. And to get them off, I mean, we actually gave up, to be perfectly honest. We couldn't go. You have to paint, and you can't really paint over them.
Yeah, there's no good answer.
There's unfortunately not a real good answer for that, Judy. And Rebecca in Madison, let's turn to you next. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. We have a pine tree in front of our house, and it's part of our neighborhood rules that we have to have one, and we thought it made it. And about October, it turned orange in literally a week, and it just dried up. I need to pull it out, and I'm supposed to plant in almost the exact same spot, so I'm wondering if there's a certain amount of time or something I should do with the soil to make sure that another tree would make it there.
Sure. Let's turn to Don Kissinger for that. Don?
So is this in a, homeowners association where you have this tree at? I guess what I'm getting at is, was the grass treated with anything in the last year or so?
No, I really think it dried up because of the drought in Madison. I mean, we kept watering it, but we might have not have done a good enough job. But no, the grass wasn't treated with anything in our yard.
Okay. And the soil that you have, is that a heavier soil, more like a clay-type soil, or is it more towards the sandy end of things?
It would be you can make little clay molds out of it.
Okay. Well, part of the problem might be then if that's the situation, you watered it maybe too much, because if it is very clay soil, it's going to hold that water, and it is actually possible to drown that tree. Potentially, when you take this tree out, what you may want to do is mix that site up with some peat moss, sand, that type of thing to get that more friable soil, so it's not like basically a pot that you put it in. And when you do plant the tree, when you dig the hole, if you have a lot of clay sides, what you want to do is you want to rough that up so the roots can penetrate that easier, and also so the soil can penetrate that. Because otherwise, you're putting it in an area that is a big pot, and it could have too much water, actually.
And should I?
Okay, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's take a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, I am Chris Thumb Superior, and I did a little impulse buying today, and I bought a gooseberry bush, and I don't know anything about it.
Oh.
What am I going to do? And also, I want to say hi, Ralph.
All right, we've got a gooseberry. Is it a trailer, or is it an erect?
I know nothing of it. And now my husband now knows.
Well, Jason, what about this?
So I think it's the gooseberry and currants are a good choice for northern Wisconsin, right? They're real winter hardy, and they can handle a wide diversity of soils, so I think it's a good choice. Now you do have to eat the gooseberries, you know.
They're
okay, good.
Good.
So it's in a nice pot there, and so as soon as the ground dries out enough, you know, pot it at the rough – or plant it at the same depth that it's in the pot, and it really doesn't need much fertility, especially the first year. So plant it, water it well, and mulch it. It responds well to wood chips or sawdust mulch, and from there it'll be fine. It'll be a little slow the first year or so as it puts down its root system, and then you'll be pleased. From that, it's just trying to keep the weeds down, particularly quackgrass, and keep some mulch on, and should be fine.
And then you need sun or just part shade or?
You know, all fruit crops are going to respond best to full sun, so this is true for gooseberry. But they can handle a little bit of shade. Currants are adapted to a little more shady environments, but you'll get your best fruit production in the full sun.
So, Ralph, start looking around for a spot around the house there in the full sun.
One thing I guess I'd like to add, too, is if you do have some white pine trees around, you want to probably keep the gooseberry a fair distance from them because that is an alternate host for white pine blister rust. And you don't want to be bringing that in, which is, you know, this gooseberry, which is nice, and then you start another problem. So be cognizant of that.
All right. And let's see. Should we take another question from the audience? Let's do that.
Hi, I'm Diana. I'm from Bayfield. And last year, this is another mold question. I have a basswood tree, and it at the end of the season, it was covered trunk and leaves, everything, with a black sooty-type mold. And I was wondering, A, how do I clean up the leaf residue that's left from that? Is that a hazard? And do you have any ideas what could have caused that?
Can you describe that black sooty mold any
kind
better?
Kind of a velvety, sappy
kind of thing. I'll bet what you've got is a... is an insect infestation there. I'll bet that that's not really a mold. I'll bet that it's what's the word I want?
We're all three racking our brains here trying to think of the word.
Yeah.
You can tell me later, Art.
it'll come to me. But I think that's your problem, Diane, because I did see quite a bit of that around last fall, and that would you'd have to maybe try and remove some of that physically.
Frass, would that be the
word
you were looking
for? We had some branches removed because we thought maybe it was an air circulation problem, but maybe not. Maybe it is some kind of bug.
A scale insect is what I wanted to say.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but I'll bet that that's it. And if it comes back, give me a call. I'll come take a look at it.
Okay. And regarding the removing the leaf litter, is it safe to do that? I was worried about inhaling, you know.
Well, if it's a mold, I would worry about it. If it's an insect infestation, I wouldn't.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thanks a lot for that question. And maybe let's turn to the phones again. And Mike in Fort Atkinson has a question. So let's go there. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. My wife has numerous flower beds in our yard, and she has something taking over the flower beds, and we believe it is Star of Bethlehem. Any ideas on how to control or get rid of it?
Star of Bethlehem. Art?
Well, that would be that would be a bulb, and I think your best bet would be to dig up the bulbs and remove them. I don't know how else you'd get rid of that unless you were very careful to use Roundup around. But if it's in a flower bed, you're not going to be able to do that. That's a matter of hand control. Yeah, that's going to spread by bulbs or bulblets.
Oh. Bulblets. Okay. So you got a little work ahead of you, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe not the answer you wanted, but it's the best one. We've got Peggy in Superior up with a question as well. Peggy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I have some very old rose bushes that I dug up the runners from my aunt's farm, and they're growing like crazy. They have a lot of foliage. But they never bloom. Can you have any ideas?
All right. So when did you dig them up? How many years ago?
Gosh, it's 4 or 5 years ago now.
Oh, okay. And where you dug them up and where you replanted them, are the conditions fairly similar?
Yeah. It's sandy loam. I have, of course, red clay here, but I have amended that soil. And okay. As I said,
and shade about the same?
Pardon me?
Shade about the same?
Yeah.
Huh.
Never bloom or seldom bloom or don't bloom at all?
Well, they have maybe one or two little. But it's the old-fashioned bush roses, you know. They're probably 100 years.
I'm thinking if you dug up roots maybe you've got old rugosa roots there that really are not doing what you think you used to see. If you used to see a hybrid rugosa and now you've got roots and they're growing up from what was below a graft or something, you may have just the old wild root there that isn't going to do much for you. So if I would think about whether or not those blooms that you do get are reminiscent of what you remember you saw in times past.
That's a very good point. That happens reasonably often, unfortunately, where the plant dies, but the graft, the root itself doesn't, and that comes up, and
you don't have much.
You don't have much, that's for sure. So so check that out, Peggy, and you might be looking at some new roses.
Yep.
Let's take another question. Let's see. Yep, let's take a question from Leslie next in Minnesota. Leslie, hi. Leslie, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. We're trying to plant some white spruce in a clearing where there used to be walnut trees, and the last 3 years we've planted hundreds. But last year was a drought, so that would explain why they didn't do very well last year. But is there some reason why white spruce may not grow in that after walnut?
Well, walnuts have a toxic chemistry or chemical in their root systems that don't allow a whole heck of a lot to grow around it. It's a defense mechanism, so I think that you may need to plant those further away from where the walnuts were. And walnut roots, well, roots from any tree, you need to remember, grow very wide, but not to grow very deep. So planting spruce trees in within that area, probably within at least 1 to 2 times the height of the tree in width, may be a tough go at it for other plants to do well within that area. I mean, the only other thing you could do, which I wouldn't recommend doing, is bringing in, you know, new soil for that. But it has what's called juglans, which is a chemical in their roots that doesn't allow other organisms to grow real well within that area.
And that hangs around even after you cut the tree down. I mean, it's years before yes. that comes out of the soil. So it's going to be there for a long, long time. And I guess if you're going to plant around that, Don, a raised bed with...
That would be another option, a raised bed, yes.
Yeah, another option, a raised bed with some sort of seal on the bottom so that the roots can't come in contact with the new plantings. And Judith Sears-Poisson has
I have two neighbors who I love dearly, but I do not love their black walnut trees very dearly because we're on a very small lot, and so my entire garden is affected. So I'm actually trying straw bale gardening this year as an option to keep it above the ground. And I have what I refer to as the container plantation of about 35-gallon buckets that I plant things in. And I have some raised beds, too. So they're still there, but I'm trying to work around them.
Very good. And that's a great question. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. We have Susan from Cottage Grove who emailed and wonders if coffee grounds are good for the soil. Are they a good soil conditioner or a mulch? What are the pros and cons of coffee grounds? And Jason, they're pretty good, aren't they?
Yeah, they're great. They just like any organic matter that's being used, it's great if you can compost it for a year first, let it break down a bit, and then it can be used right in the soil. Otherwise, it's going to have to stay on top of the soil as a mulch. Otherwise, it will really tie up nitrogen. But otherwise, yeah, it's a great soil amendment.
I can add to that. At our house, we've got 4 or 5 blueberry bushes that are almost trees, and we put that on, we top dress it basically. And our blueberries are as big as your thumb. I mean, they're wonderful. Oh. So they do a great job.
Somebody called last week. Runs around and gets coffee grounds from several coffee shops. He gets hundreds of pounds.
And I think he was using it for worm composting.
Yeah, he was using it for worm composting. So I guess it works pretty well for that as well. So vermiculture. All right. We have... Faith on Facebook commented that the previous caller's crocus may be planted too deep. She suggested to replant them at 4 inches deep. That's a possibility. Oh, it sounds like they've been there a long time, but I guess there's no reason, even if they've been there a long time, dig them up and plant them a little shallower. So that's a good point. And we have a question from the audience. Yes.
Hi, I'm Linda from Anaqua. I've got a kinkakoo tree peony and planted it a long time ago. It took several years before I got any flowers on it at all. When it flowered a solid yellow instead of the yellow red that it's supposed to be. And then the following year, I had an herbaceous peony come up behind it. I understand that they're grafted together somehow. And I'm now getting an herbaceous red. And I'm wondering if there's anything I can do that would bring it back to the true tree peony that I was looking for initially.
Oh, interesting. You got us all shaking our heads here, scratching our heads, I should say.
What was the color of the bloom originally that you expected?
It was supposed to be a yellow with red veins coming through it. And it actually came out as a yellow... Just a solid yellow.
I think you did not get the tree peony that you expected you were buying.
I will contact the company.
and that happens. I hope it doesn't happen more often than not, but it happens enough that.
And tree peonies are an expensive item, so I would really look into that one.
Yeah, you wanna check that. Out. And just as a follow-up, go ahead.
Would there be any benefit to cutting away the herbaceous peony? Because they're coming from the same spot.
I don't think the two are connected physically.
But really. I never planted an herbaceous.
I don't think that has anything to do with the flower color or the tree peony at all.
Okay.
All right, I have a few people, Don Kissinger, have asked me about this, and I'm glad to have you here to ask to post the question to you, and that has to do with the emerald ash borer. the emerald ash borer, people are wondering what's the status on the ash borer. Actually, also the gypsy moth. We can talk about both of them. Well, let's take the emerald ash borer first. A lot of people with ash trees that are wondering, should I just go ahead and cut the thing down and start over, or what's going on in the way of methods to control? So just a kind of an update.
An update is in Wisconsin right now, there's, I guess, 15 counties that are quarantined. 13 of those counties actually have emerald ash borer in them. Fond du Lac and Sheboygan do not, but what happened is where EAB was found was close enough to the border that they did quarantine those. So basically, you know, north central Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, as of today, does not have EAB. Now, that can change. One thing to make note of is emerald ash borer, the first probably 2 or 3 years that it is inside a tree, and it usually starts at the top of the tree and moves itself down, you don't notice the decline that much. In years 3, 4, yes, you do. So what we're telling folks, again, is that unless you know that EAB is within, you know, 15 miles of your vicinity, treatment, we are not recommending treatment. There are treatments out there that are very effective. If you asked me this probably 3, 4 years ago, I would say there really isn't. But there are some chemicals out there that do a good job. The one thing you need to look at is the size of your tree. If they're, you know, 20 inches or larger, you use a different chemical than the other trees. When I work with communities, the number one thing I ask them to do is find out how many ash they have, the size of the ash, and what condition they're in, because that'll really dictate as to what a community should do. Now, for an urban setting, you know, keep looking at your tree. D-shaped exit holes is the adult emerging. Declining limbs, you know, where from the top down you aren't getting as much leafing and the leaves are smaller. That's a concern. But EAB is moving. Be prepared for it. Just, you know, go on our website. The website is www.emeraldashborer.wi.gov, and there's a whole plethora of information that you can look at. And they have stuff for homeowners. You know, there are picks for homeowners in particular that you can find that information. But it's killed over 100 million ash trees in the Midwest right now, and it'll just keep moving.
Wow. Talking about a lot of things, emerald ash borer is among them, but about your garden, too, you can join in. I hope you will. Send us a note on email at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Our guest today from the Bayfield Pavilion, Bayfield, Wisconsin, Jason Fischbach, Don Kissinger, and Art Odie. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller broadcasting from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, kicking off Bayfield in Bloom with a great audience, a wonderful audience, and some great guests, too. Jason Fischbach is the UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield. Don Kissinger from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator. And Art Odie, Horticulture Consultant, semi-retired from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. So nice to have them all with us. We will try a – let's take a phone call next, and Pat – in Washburn up Hello. Here with a question. Pat, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, everybody. I'm getting to listen to you as I make compost for my onions today. And I have a comment about the astilbe. In my estimation, they grow best in a heavy soil. I've tried them on sand here, and I've given up. So they like a lot of moisture and fertilizer. And I have a question for Jason. Jason, I called you last year about my sour cherries that got an ooze on the trunk. And I forgot what you told me was happening with that. And I'm wondering if I can save them and if the sweet cherries and the other cherries that are around them are going to be able to survive.
All right.
Yeah, right. So the amber ooze on the sweet cherries and the tart cherries in particular is eventually what ends up killing the tart cherries. They just don't last that long. It's called bacterial canker, and it infects the tree through frost damage or other injury to the trunk, and it gets into the vascular system of the tree, and eventually it just starts girdling branches, and it and it dies. That's why those trees are replaced every 15 or 20 years. It can spread through rain splashing, and sweet cherries tend to be even more susceptible than the tart cherries, and it's one of the major limitations to sweet cherry production up here in the north, because we have a bit more frost damage or winter injury cracking to the trunk, and we get the bacterial canker moving in. So there isn't much you can do with it. If you see some cankered branches, you can prune them out and just hope for the best, but be prepared. You're likely going to have to replant at some point.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Let's take another call while we're at it and go to Appleton and talk with Amy. Amy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. I'm hoping somebody can identify a very strange plant that came up in my very large clay pot that has a very heavy clay soil in it that is hard as concrete. So it's basically turned into a bird bath. And one of the birds left some volunteers. I got some marsh grass that came up. And I had a very strange plant that came up with very thick, dark green, leathery leaves that were very deeply veined. The leaves were probably 6 to 8 inches long and 4 or 5 inches across and tapered to a point. And it sent up a stalk in the center that grew to about 3 feet high with a tulip head, big tulip head type thing on the top. And within a day of that ripening, it opened up and it sent out, oh, they look like praying mantis. They were 4 to 5 inches long, just a green stick, and then another green stick that just unfolded like a umbrella. And I had 5 or 6 stalks of that, and on each junction, there were little tiny 3-petal white flowers that kind of closed in on itself with a yellow and purple center. And they lasted all summer.
Labs photography. Wow.
I think we need a photograph.
That's a lot to take in.
That is really, you watch that carefully. Jason, you have any ideas?
Excellent description, but I'm with Art. I think we need a picture to be able to identify it.
I'm hoping it comes
sounds
back
like
an
interesting
year.
Plant. And if it's birds bringing it in, who knows?
Is it a compound leaf or a simple leaf?
You
I think we might have lost her.
It's just a oblong, straight-edged leaf.
Okay.
Still no help. If you can, listen, if that comes back up again.
I would take a look at it.
Yeah.
If you send me a photograph, or just out of curiosity, I would.
If
you send me a photograph.
Open up. It was fascinating.
Yeah, and if it's really something that I would think was that unusual and that interesting, then I would think that you ought to send it to UW to the herbarium.
Yeah, it's certainly worth. Please take some photos of it this year if you haven't, if you didn't last year.
Or I hesitate to say this because I don't want to get inundated with stuff. But if you want to send me an email and if you have any photographs, just email me some photographs. I'd be happy to take a look at them.
Okay, well, I'm hoping it comes up again this year, because then I'll take photographs. I was too busy watching it last year. I didn't take pictures.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And please do send some photos in. You can send them to Art, or even send them in to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and I can make sure Art sees them or anybody else. I'm sure there'll be people who will be looking at it and trying to and taking a guess for sure. Thanks again. Let's take a question from the audience.
I'm Craig Grau from Duluth, Minnesota. I have 2 Harrelson trees. One doesn't look like it's going to make it too much longer. Do I need 2, or will losing one cost me both of them?
Yeah, so you do need 2 apple trees to get apples because they have to cross-pollinate, but you're probably fine because the bees are going to move pollen a long ways. And your neighbors probably have apple trees even down the block, even 1 or 2, or there's some growing wild somewhere. So even though officially you need 2, because our apples are all over the place and the bees move it around, usually you're fine. If you notice on that healthier tree, you see a lot of flowers, but you don't see much for fruit after that, then you've got probably going to have to plant another apple tree because for whatever reason you're not getting pollen to that tree. But yeah.
Okay. And Jeanette and Ladysmith, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for letting me join in. And I'm glad somebody broached rugosa roses. I love them. I have a rugosa that is, I don't know, maybe 10 years old at least, and it has done extremely well. It's white, it's single-petaled, huge blossoms, very, very fragrant. It's been beautiful. It's been wonderful. I went out to trim it this year. The core is dead, and there's an awful lot of stuff coming up around the outside. Now, because it's a rugosa, am I going to get rugosa back up, or is this potluck, and who knows what I'll have?
Sounds like a potluck deal to me, but Arnoldi, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you get, potluck.
Unfortunately, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Talking today with Jason Fishbach from the UW Extension, Don Kissinger with the Department of Natural Resources, and horticulture consultant Art Odie, having a great time broadcasting from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin. It's always a great time to be able to kick off the Bayfield in Bloom festival that really goes on for another, oh gosh, at least through another month. You're going to have a chance to see some wonderful plantings and some great flowers. And I'm telling you, the flowers just through the village of Bayfield are something to behold. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're broadcasting today from Bayfield, Wisconsin. Beautiful Bayfield at the Bayfield Pavilion. With a very large and friendly audience, a bunch of great people here as we celebrate the beginning of Bayfield in Bloom. It's going to be going on for the next, month at least, and probably then some. If you want to learn about all the activities, I think you go to the Chamber's website at bayfield.org. You're going to find out all of the things that are going on when you come to visit this area. In the meantime, you may have some gardening questions. And whether it's trees or shrubs or whether it's vegetables or flowers, we've got the answers for you with Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties, Don Kissinger with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's a forestry coordinator, community forestry coordinator, and Art Odie. Art's a hort consultant and semi-retired from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. So they do a wonderful job and appreciate your input. So you want to shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. That's great. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And, of course, from the audience, we always have great questions from our audience. And why don't we, Judith, why don't we take a question from there?
Hi. My name is Sylvia Whalen. I'm from Ashland, Wisconsin. And I heard something just yesterday that sounds too good to be true, so I'm dying to ask this question. And I've been experimenting with cover crops lately in my vegetable garden, and I've had really good luck with the things I've tried. And yesterday I heard that if you plant mustard, and I don't know what kind of mustard seed, that's a super crop that if you let it die back, all that leaf will decay, and it'll literally kill any like fungus or bacteria that you're having problems with in your garden. So I thought, this sounds too good to be true, so I want to know what your take is on the growing mustard for a cover crop.
What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, there is actually some evidence that suggests that the exudates from the rotting mustard family, something like canola, for example, will almost act as a soil fumigant, where it will suppress the growth of some microorganisms. It's used primarily, I think, or where the benefits I've seen is with nematode populations. And so we'll see some folks in commercial fruit production use these as a cover crop to as a natural soil fumigant, if you will. Now, with all of these cover crops and particularly claims that are made, it's so situation dependent, how it was grown, what the moisture is like, what the soil chemistry is like, all these different variables, why it's so hard to just make a blanket statement that that's what it does. But there is some evidence that mustard can be an effective cover crop with some anti-nematode.
And you're a gardener, you're an experimenter. Why not? Why not give it a try? Jeff in Rockton sent us a note, called with a question about hops, actually. He started them from a rhizome, and after a few seasons, there are very few shoots coming up from the center. They're all coming up as runners, and if he digs up where the original rhizomes were, will the runners be affected? That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they should be fine if you dig out that center because they should have root themselves. A rhizome has got buds all along that stem. It's just an underground stem, and so where you have that bud, it'll put down both roots and send up a new shoot, so it should be fine. And I'm not that familiar with hops. We don't have a lot of hops production up here, so it'd be worth checking with the track down your extension agent and have them do a little digging, because the question is why is that center rotting out and not growing, because it should be regrowing from that same spot.
I'm trying to think of one website. There's Gorst Valley Hops might be a place to go. They've got a website, Gorst Valley Hops, they sell hops and produce hops, and I think on their page they have some information that may cover that area, so it'd be worth a look anyway. Let's take a question from the audience.
Sure. My name is Karen Ohm, and I'm from Fish Creek, Wisconsin. And we became the proud parents of probably about 200 red wigglers. So we're starting to compost with worms. So now that they're starting to compost, I need to know the next step. What do we do with that and how to use it properly, and also the liquid, which I think it might be called lychee, is that correct, from the worms?
Yeah. We got a vermiculturist here in the group. Art's not.
I was looking around to see if Bay Area permaculture is in the building, because he's done a lot of vermicomposting and would have some suggestions.
We just talked about that the other day on the program. And
Wednesday.
It was Wednesday, and I'm racking my brains to remember exactly, but I think you just use it as well.
I actually have a couple worm bins with a bunch of red wigglers.
This is Judith, by the way.
This is Judith. and you can use it in a variety of ways. The worm castings are really potent fertilizer, so you only really need, you can mix it in like maybe a quarter with potting soil if you're going to be starting new plants, or you can make a tea out of it and use the kind of like a compost tea, or you can top dress even house plants and they just love it. So yeah, you can, those worms do good work. They eat junk mail, they eat pretty much anything. They don't like onions and they don't like citrus. It's a little rough on them. So, but yeah, lots of great uses for it.
And those red wigglers are the ones to use too, because the plain old earthworms just don't eat the same way those red wigglers do. Plus, you can use them for fishing too. So it's a dual purpose worm for sure. Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Kate from Duluth, and my question is simply: what is the best way to fertilize flowering pots without using synthetics? And I'm specifically wondering about compost tea or fish emulsion or things like that. And I'm wondering, because I don't like to use the Miracle-Gro. So
the fish emulsion has been used successfully with irrigating potted plants or fertigating them. You just have to, ideally, you would know what the concentration is of the nutrients in that product that you're using, so you're not over or under fertilizing with that product. Compost tea, although it does have some nutrients in it, it's used more as a for disease control, where you're trying to outcompete negative or bad populations of organisms with the harmless populations within the compost tea. So it does have some nutritive value, but not, it's more the fish emulsion, which is what I'd recommend. The other one is just to start with a real good, well-balanced soil mix that has adequate compost and organic matter to hold the nutrients that are in there.
We have a lime tree, which we call Limey. You might know. And Limey gets fish emulsion, and Limey is doing really well. Limey's got lots of limes. And so it's working pretty well. We're letting her sit out now during the day. And all winter, Limey had to sit in the bedroom. But we had lights on Limey all summer, or all winter, and did really quite well with the fish emulsion. I always recommend, if you're inside, though, if you're leaving for the day, the time to put the fish emulsion on is in the morning just before you leave. And by the time you get home, it's kind of soaked in, I guess. And Here we have another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Lisa from Washburn. We bought a home about a year and a half ago and inherited a lot of really cool things and a lot of not so cool things. One of them is a great raspberry plant, but we have snow on the mountain starting to invade. It's pretty established. It's probably about 12 by 12, and it's been there for a long time. And I'm just wondering if it's going to be a problem, the snow on the mountain creeping in there.
I don't think that's terribly aggressive. I'd live with it for a while and see what it does.
So I kind of agree. It's in the raspberries? It's in the raspberries. Yeah, so, you know, raspberries are notorious. It's impossible to weed them, right? I mean, you have to be at it all the time. So it's sort of pick your poison. You want quack grass or snow on the mountain. And if you've got that as it's acting as a cover crop, the issue would be, are the primacanes coming up through that snow on the mountain okay? Most likely they are. And then is there adequate fertility within the raspberry plant? And you can sort of use your rule of thumb where if you're getting good production, it probably has enough nutrients. But you can also do a tissue test of the raspberry plants to see, are they healthy? Are they getting what they need, or is the snow on the mountain stealing it all? But okay. If you're going to try to get rid of it, you know, good luck. So you sort of have to live with it, I think. Think of it as a living mulch.
Yeah, it is. It does make a nice mulch. It keeps the weeds down.
That's yeah, good. Perfect.
Okay.
Rosemary from Appleton wondered if you can plant flowering kale from seed.
I don't see why not. The question would be, would you get the same kale back that you saved the seed from? And no, if it's a hybrid plant that you're saving the seed from. But, yeah, you can plant kale from seed. Start it early, and it'll grow all year.
All right, and any other questions from the audience, we'll be glad to have those questions. But I want to go back to Don Kissinger, because we talked about emerald ash borers, and the one thing I also mentioned that we didn't get back to, well, I almost forgot, gypsy moths. Yeah. What's the status? People are wondering, what's the status on gypsy moths?
Well, I think if you're from the Bayfield area, it's a concern, because I know that the number from trap counts was pretty high in the Bayfield County area. Basically, in Wisconsin, two-thirds of the state is, I guess, what you would call generally infested. The very western third is not, and that's where the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection are doing some sprays this year. Actually, I guess 24 western counties are going to be sprayed. You know, gypsy moth, to me, is something that you want to, I guess, keep it at a, you know, dull roar. But if you have healthy trees, they're going to be defoliated a little bit, but they'll come back year in and year out. But if it's something where you have 2-3 years of defoliation, then your tree is going to be in bad shape. So DATCAP is doing, one, you know, sprays in 24 counties. DNR does some spraying, but the spraying is with in the area of eastern Wisconsin, and that's on a cost share basis. So, you know, gypsy moth is moving. I remember when I was in college in the early 80s, we did trapping, and really it wasn't a big problem at that time. It is slowly moving westward. You know, keep your trees healthy, and they should be fine.
I have a kind of a philosophical outlook on gypsy moth. We lived in New York for a long time, and gypsy moths would come through and defoliate trees, and in July it would look like it was November, and they'd leaf out again. And gypsy moths are called gypsy moths because they move around, and unless they really come back and hit you several years in a row, it's just something you have to live with. I personally don't like the idea of spraying for them. I think it's more of a waste of money in most cases than anything. But I can see that if you live in a highly urbanized area, people do get upset because of the way things look and the frass from the mm-hmm. caterpillars and everything. But really, there's a lot of things worse than gypsy moths.
Yeah. I guess something else to mention is when they do spray, they use an organic compound called Bexillothuringiensis christaki, or BTK for short, and it's used in organic farming. So it's people get concerned about it, you know, getting on them or getting on their pets and that kind of stuff. I guess unless you may become, and I don't, you know, allergic potentially, which I think that's a minute, you know, potential. What they do use is a rational system. So as Art said, you know, keep your trees healthy, and you know, gypsy moth comes and goes.
There we go. Let's take another question from the audience. Yeah. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Barb from Highbridge, and I just have a comment. 1998, I was at Old Wisconsin in October, and they had dug up their bulbs for the fall, and they were selling them. And I bought maybe 10 amaryllis bulbs, and I forgot about them. They were in a brown bag in my bedroom. And that spring, I found them. They had started growing the green shoots, so I thought, well, you know, amaryllis doesn't grow out in northern Wisconsin. I planted them, and they still come up every year, and I still get purple flowers on them.
Ah! Are you the green thumb? Wow. That. The benign neglect works. We can. I've got another question, actually, that I wanted to ask Jason, which somebody had questions about fruit trees. What are good fruit trees to grow there? And they're a great addition to the garden. Sometimes a little intimidating, I think, for people. But for someone without acres to plant, you know, a small, you know, yard, what do you recommend? What are some compact fruits that are kind of nice for that situation?
Yeah, I think the more the merrier, all that you can fit in there. So apples and pears would be your standbys. And depending where you are in the state, looking at tart and sweet cherries, and even there's a new plum, relatively new plum called Black Ice. You do need a pollinator with that. And I think generally the, I don't know where I heard it, but with respect to fruit trees, do it nice or do it twice. And that means managing your deer. Because you're making a big investment, and if you lose all the ends of the sticks to the deer every year, you know, what's the point? So then what do you do, right? So deer repellents or cages to exclude them. But unless you've got a plan for those deer, I don't think it's worth planting fruit trees. You're just going to waste your money. So that said, you can plant the more aggressive or standard trees that have the full-size trees, rootstock, instead of the dwarfing, and you can get those trees out of the browse line. And there's some interesting ways that you can trellis apple trees to keep them compact and manageable, but get them out of the deer. Some of this vertical gardening where you're putting them on a trellis but getting them tall off the ground. So, you know, we can do the same thing with pear trees and the whole range. We can really trellis them and manipulate their shape. So,
very cool, very cool. We had a totally different question that relates to potatoes. So Irv from Black River Falls was wondering how to plant potatoes with long eyes. You got eyes that are over 2 feet. You know, I had this once at an old farmhouse where I lived. We forgot about the potatoes and never went in the basement. And, you know, it was one of these old kind of dugout basements. And it looked like something from, I thought, oh, I wish I had a movie camera I could do a horror film. Because those eyes in those potatoes were, it was like some strange creature. And it sounds like that's what Irv's got. What do you think?
Well, is it worth it? Would be first question.
Yeah.
Right?
It was in my case. I had thought, no. This they went out to.
So the second one, what you could try is take some really nice potting soil in a tray and lay that eye down and bury it, right? Maybe an inch or so. Keep it well watered, and you're likely to see multiple little plantlets coming up from each of those nodes, and then you can plant out the plants instead of the actual tuber. I've never tried that, but it might be worth trying because they're just so fragile. You put them in the ground, they're going to snap off anyway. And even if you have one or two of those long eyes, there might still be some viable buds on that potato tuber, and it'll just send up new if you plant it. But, you know, they get to the point where you should probably not be saving potatoes anyway. You know, I know that's not supposed to say that probably, but you should be planting certified potato seed each year so that you're not carrying over disease issues. You're not carrying over viruses that have accumulated. So that might be best just to plant new seed.
And let's see. Jessica wondered, how do you deal with squash vine borer? Squash vine borer.
Pinch them. Squeeze them. Step on them. I don't know.
Yeah, that's... Squash vine borers, obviously not having that problem right now, but had them last summer sometime. Anything...
I'm not exactly sure on the timing, but I know in squash production generally they're moving more to these low row covers or low tunnels where it's just a small little hoop placed over the row and you've got the floating row cover over the top, and that ends up excluding a lot of the pests that might be laying eggs or moving on to the squash plants. It's just a question of, because you've got to move it off at some point when the vines expand beyond the boundaries, and will they get attacked after that point? But that's something to try for a range of plants.
And a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I live in Bayfield here. And my question was actually, you had mentioned a correlation between the gooseberry plant and maybe hosting or having something to do with the white pine blister rust. I'm actually going to be putting a garden in someone else's yard right up adjacent to the ravine at the top of town here. And I just don't want to put anything in that might have any negative effects on the trees up there. I was wondering if you could warn me if there's any other fruit trees or herbaceous perennials, anything like that, that could host some kind of negative thing like that.
Okay.
Well, the white pine blister rust is prevalent in Bayfield, and we have a number of large white pine that I know of in the city that are actively infested now, so I think you do have to be careful with any of the currant family. But I think that most currants and blueberries, gooseberries that are sold now are rust resistant. Is that right,
yes.
Jason?
Yep. You can check with the nursery to make sure the variety you've got is resistant to white pine blister rust. Other than that, I'm trying to think what might be moving from domesticated into your wild trees, and it's probably more the other way around, the pests from the wild trees moving into your fruit trees. So beyond the currants and gooseberries, I don't think there's...
Well, you should keep in mind apple trees and cedar apple rust, too. And the red cedar trees, the junipers, shouldn't be planted within a couple of hundred feet, I think, of the apple trees.
Wonderful. Boy, the time flies every year. It goes so fast. We're all about out of time. I want to thank everybody, John Munson, certainly, and John Talcott, and our engineer, John, Jennifer Dargan, our on-air production, Michelle Good, technical production, Jason Fishbach, Don Kissinger, and Art Odie, of course, Judith Sears-Poisson, Rudy Listig, our engineer, and Ginger Alden from our development department. It always takes a lot of people to put on a show like this, and it also takes a great audience, and we had a great audience today, and I want to thank you all for being with us. We're going to be hopefully doing this again next year. We'll all be a year older and maybe a little smarter, and I'm hoping we'll do it again. Thanks again. From the Bayfield Pavilion, I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.